You're listening to the BBC at 88.3 FM in Central Wellington.
Vault is set to start.
Die 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 return to the orientation circuit for a repeat show at reorientation. Die 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 with Peace War into the Bat. Thursday, July the 16th at Bar Bodega. Pre-sales are $10, available from Voosa and undertheradar.co.nz.
Reorientation 09 and the BBC present Dimmer with Family Cactus. Shane Carter has been working on the follow-up to Dimmer's acclaimed third album, There My Dear, and the result is one of the most potent recordings of his remarkable career. Degrees of Existence, due for release at the end of July. Dimmer with Family Cactus, Saturday, July 18th at Bodega. Pre-sale tickets are $20, available from undertheradar.co.nz.
Retrovice, countering the counterculture since 6 months ago. Mondays, 4 to 7, BBC 88.3 FM.
Greeting, you've come to the BBC 88.3. Before then, we had The Subliminals with Speed of Sound. It's an amazing song about an amazing band. Just a muck around thing on the side, but you know. Sometimes they can come up with some pretty amazing things. And Dimmer, whoa, totally going to that. $20, that's a steal. Anyway, you're on the Joel Cosgrove Variety Hour, still floating around trying to find a better name than this, but oh well. Better that than nothing. A couple of steps ahead of that anyway. We've got an interview with Matt McCartan set up this afternoon. And so we'll talk about the new Labour Party, which formed into the Alliance, and all the sort of ideas that float around with that. Also talk about Unite and their campaign for $15 minimum wage, something I'm involved in personally, but I also think is quite an interesting idea and an interesting discussion that really needs to be pushed, and through this campaign is being pushed. I'll set it up so we can enjoy some songs in the meantime. We'll start off with some Fort Creature, Shake About.
Thank you. I can.
In the studio, and Matt is currently the General Secretary of Unite.
Yep.
These things always confuse me.
It's General Secretary, but everyone just calls me the National Secretary. So I think I'm tired of being called the National Secretary. So that's fine.
The nominal leader of Unite Union. And so Matt was involved with the Labour Party and then the Alliance, or the New Labour Party, which turned into the Alliance from there, and then from there into Unite in a not quite straight pathway. And so I just pulled him in to talk with him today about that, radical politics, radical unionism, and the ideas of organising workers, especially low-paid workers, and also the low-paid in general. So we'll jump into that from there. So I guess, Matt, where did you start from? How did you end up in the Labour Party? How did you end up splitting from the Labour Party?
Yes, well, I mean, I've always been a worker activist, I suppose, from my first job, and that's my first love, or my first sort of, that's where my heart is, and everything I've done, I've tried to, you know, it's kind of I'm tribal, you know, it's kind of where I am. So I worked on the shop floor, first dispute I was involved in when I was 18 in Queenstown, actually. We occupied a hotel there when they tried to, they shut down in the seasons. This is in the late 70s. They used to shut the town down and throw everyone out on the street. So we used to live in accommodation in those days, in the hotels. We used to live there. So people talk it on themselves that we should get part-time work and shouldn't lose our accommodation. So that was the first struggle, sort of, if you like. And there wasn't actually a union in town. There was involved in officials. They won it, and we sorted out and come to a compromise. So I suppose that was the first time I sort of really got a sense of how collectively you can win things which are fair, which you had no show in as doing as individuals. So that was kind of, I suppose, a pathway along the sort of politics and the and it gave more of a form to my politics. So I was very involved in the trade union movement at a young age as a worker activist, and I liked to stay on the shop floor. You know, I never felt that I wanted to be a trade union official, but I was always active in the union wherever I was. So I was involved in activist stuff in Auckland when I moved to Auckland, and then you know, we organised social clubs between the hotels. I was working in the hotels in those days, and that sort of morphed into things. And then I stood for the union executive, and then we went through a very big dispute where I then ran for the presidency of the union. And it was a massive campaign across the country. And
for your presidency, or was there?
Yes. For the dispute. But out of that, I made a decision to run for the presidency with a slate. Some of us had been arrested at the time, and we had a four-day strike, and we won a national strike, and that was very much run by the rank and file. And we then brought some years back doing quite a lot of change. But what we went through in my 20s, in my early 20s, we went through and we actually did very well industrially. You know, had a very proactive, you know, we even had our own bar, you know, which used to go to 5 in the morning. In fact, we used to go all night, almost every night. And, of course, you know, 5 o'clock and more and when you got 300 there. So, I mean, it was, you know, a lot of young people and were very active. And so we fought for better conditions in the hotels and won them, and we had a few years of being really quite progressive and quite as we used to think of ourselves, quite staunch. You know, we're all young, we're all full of ourselves, and what we did though, that over a period of time the employees fought back, and you know, we had losses, and what that taught me was that you also had to be you had to come to political views, because I remember we'd get called down to the parliament at the time as youngsters and told by Preble, actually, and Douglas and some of the others, that our pay claims were too high, and it was that stage they were trying to manage the wage explosion, and you know, it wasn't, and so that sort of taught me.
Can I pull you away from there? Because that's okay. Something that's totally that you don't see anymore is politicians being directly involved in that manner. How did that operate? What role did Preble and
Bonner? What happened was there was a wage freeze sort of by Muldoon last year. and then the wage freeze came off, and then workers went and fought for wage increases, and the Labor government just been elected, this is in 84, saying, well, you know, we've got to have some constraints. And the unions had agreed, you know, the officialdom had, so they'd agreed. But we believed that we were poorer, and so we had a right to demand more, which we did, and we've been very successful. The employers went to the government of the day and said, you've got to stop these maddies, you know, they're running around causing us trouble, disrupting our hotels. So we were summoned to Wellington to be told, our officials were told, is that we had to kind of be reasonable, and the employers had been in there. So it was one of those ironies when we negotiated in Wellington in the old hotel workers building, which isn't there now. But we negotiated all night till 7 in the morning, and well, we settled up a deal. And then that was probably a great lesson to me, whereas as we got battered back by the state as well as the employer's strength, what that came to me is that you can't just win it as a syndicalist, you know, is that just industrial might itself, and that, so that sort of was more of a political awakening, you know, and gave me some form and so on. So our union was affiliated to the Labor Party. I didn't join until they changed the rules in the Labor Party. I was the president, and so we'd go to their conferences, and the first conference I went in, they brought the GST in. Well, you know, they approved the GST as a, and it was a regressive tax. And actually, our members are worse off. So under a Labor government in 85, and, you know, we've got rid of Muldoon, that we actually were supporting a party which actually made low-paid worse off. So I made a decision then, because, you know, I couldn't see the strategic way I thought is going to the Labor Party and fight with the left against the Rogenones, because they were in full flight at that stage. So I was in there for a couple of years, and you know, I lived in Auckland Central, so we took on old Preble, and that was a battle in itself on the streets. And anyway, that was a whole story which led to us as forming a faction inside the Labor Party, a worker branch. And so we were kind of a rank and file workers by and large, you know, whole network of our network. We had branches up and down the country, and they, to some extent, became the stormtroopers against the right. They had a thing called the Backbone Club, so you had a right faction and a left faction, although we were more of a worker faction. And then, of course, there was the left, traditional left within the Labor Party, which was around Jim Anderson, it was called the Economic Policy Network, which was kind of the policy group which argued against the Rogenomics. And so we made that link with that group. And then we had our successes, but it was bloody hard. And so by that time, I'd become a full-time official. I'd stepped down from the presidency. And so we fought inside the Labor Party, got Preble on the ropes, and he took us all to court. Okay, so he lost the vote, and he took the party to court. He took all of us to court, took me to court. I was first defendant, and our union was second defendant, I think.
How could he take you to court?
I just did, you know, just power, you know. So that procedure, yes, power. You just, I took us to the High Court and sued us for all sorts of things, and then the Labor government at the time, well, the Rogenomes in the government, you know, they said, I was only young kid then, you know, but they said to us is that they said in the court caucus, if Preble hangs, we all hang. So they took an attack against our union. The union leadership shat themselves, quite frankly, and I can see why they did. You know, I was just young, you know, just fighting and scrap around. And 17 MPs wrote a letter to Long and said unless we were pulled into line, that they would resign and form a new party. This is under first past the post. So I was very keen they did that. Of course, you know, I was one of the young ones. They got called in and sort of told the reality of life. And so we backed off and got away. So my heart went out of it. Then I just thought, well, I don't believe that you can change things in the Labor Party, because when you do look like you can win, that even your leadership in the liberal left will actually line up for stability, and, you know, we've got to keep it together. So I'd come quite close to Anderton for a short period, and then he resigned in frustration and come up and saw me, and I suggested, well, why don't we form a new party, a workers' party, sort of party.
and I committed to leave my job if he did that and be his organiser, at least till the next election. If we got 5% and he won his seat, well, then we'd stick around, and if not, well, at least we had a good scrap. So he did that, and we launched the NLP, and we got up to about 4,000 men, sort of members, in about 3 months, and that had its challenges as well, and you know, and that sort of set the next stage. So that was really my entry into politics.
So I guess Bryce Edwards, who's a politically political, what's it?
He's a political studies lecturer.
Sort of down in Otago. I think there's not much else you can do apart from being in Otago. It's quite barren.
It's very cold there, Bryce. I went to school there. It's bloody cold.
Yeah, I've got family down there. It's not the best of places, but I mean, actually, I've got to say, when there's some nice sun and a good breeze, it's quite a handy little place to hang out in. Anyway, the question he puts there in his summary, I think I've downloaded it, was about 145 pages in total, so it's a decent little bit there. And the central question he asks is, why and how do these parties, and by that he's referencing to the New Labour Party, the Alliance, change both their policy and their political strategies? And I guess that's something I'm quite interested in, because you get something from the New Labour Party, which has been described by various commentators and various accounts that I've read over the past couple of years as being quite focused, quite class focused, quite specific, and then it develops into the Alliance, and from there develops into what happened in 2001, where it split over the issue of Afghanistan. How did it start from that initial period of that breakaway from the Labour Party, that grassroots movement from the Labour Party, into what Bryce describes as an oligarchical leadership group? Do you agree with that? And what was the developments around there?
Well, I think that Bryce has a reasonable analysis of it, but you know, it's always in retrospect, and when you're an academic, you can step away from it, and you've got, you know, a bit of historical view. But you kind of, with all these things, you make it up as you.
Were you there? Hello? What happened? Oh no, is Matt? What happened to Matt? Oh, we'll be right back. That's the VBC 88.3. Sorry about that. We had phone-related difficulties, so we'll have a go at this interview again. Hey, Matt, you there?
I am.
Excellent. Okay. I was going to segue between the developing the rise of the alliance and then its collapse in the early 2000s, but
now it's too depressing.
Then we'll stay on this happy note and the lilt on your laugh, and we'll move into Unite. One of the things that Bryce talks about with the original formation of the Labour Party is that the formation of the party, the Labour Party, was an attempt to establish a political wing for the industrial labour movement. I'm quite interested in how the idea of Unite as a social movement as much as a sort of bureaucratic union to fight for workers' pay, how that interrelates within this whole $15 campaign, because it seems to be a lot the aim of it a lot more than just raising the minimum wage in itself.
No, you've got to build a social movement, and you're quite right. But I will just sort of couple of things to just take that story from where we were talking before, because I think it's important.
Fair enough.
We went through the thing, we formed the alliance, we formed with the Labour Party, and then all the contradictions sort of came to a thing. But in the end, you're either pro-worker or you actually believe in a pro-market society. So that was an internal conflict. The Afghanistan War was the straw that broke the back. Actually, it wasn't the reason. And so that imploded, and then, you know, and that will come to grief. So we'd came to a view saying you cannot just solve things electorally. You've got to build in the community, and you've got to build grassroots. Electoral things are important, but unless you actually build a social movement on the ground, it won't work. So this is why we said, right, we unite. It's a community union. It was already there. A lot of the people from the new Labour Party Alliance were already active in it in voluntary roles. So we took the project on. It's actually building workers' power and building it in the community. So that's been the project now for nearly 6 years. We've run different campaigns around, you know, class issues or money issues or economic issues. The first one was raising the minimum wage to $12, the supersize my pay, which we think was very successful in getting wages. Now we're doing the $15 an hour sort of minimum, because we've got to keep the issue on the working poor and on people's ability to earn a living wage. Now we're running a referendum for $15 an hour. In part, there's nothing special about the first $15 an hour. You still can't live on that, but most of the parties will line up on that. That's the CTU position, the Council of Trade Union position, and there seems to be a consensus around it. So we're doing it as a referendum, and it's not running the referendum per se, but it's actually building that people get involved in the campaign and workers are talking about the issue of their incomes. And that's what it's about. And we're getting a lot of support from students, from your students too, down to Victoria there. And but it is an issue on the work sites, and that people are starting to see that wages and your ability to earn a living, you cannot just do that with your boss. You know, they've got a recession on too, and they've got their rents to pay and their other bills to pay. And so in the end, we've got a model in our country, in most Western countries now, is that we buy into the shareholding class. We say the competition is between shareholders' profit versus customers to get them to the lowest price possible, and the workers aren't even considered in that model. And when they are, they just consider the cost. What we have to get back at debate and say, what does it cost a worker or a New Zealander or a citizen to be able to earn as a reasonable wage to have a reasonable life? And this is what this referendum is about, is getting the debate on. The community has got to take some ownership and saying, this is what any employer sets up in business or corporations that come into our country and set up here. You say, we have expectations that people earn a living wage. If people can't pay a living wage, then maybe they shouldn't be in business. And I suppose that that's a new approach, and that's what we've got to argue out. And we want to have that debate in New Zealand. We have to change the thinking in New Zealand. So our union, you know, we back ourselves, you know, we're full of ourselves. So we go, yes, we're going to do it. And 19 out of 20 people will sign our petition. We want to get, you know, the referendum doesn't have a good rep at the moment because it's a silly old smacking thing. But what we want to do is we've got to get 400,000 names onto our petition. and we're going to run it. It gets signed by a lot of people. It's just mechanically, and you know, it's going to be difficult because we need lots of, you know, need thousands of volunteers to help us actually. And we've got the next May to do it. And if we get 400,000 names, you know, because we're all about double ups, but we'll be able to have a referendum in this country about the $15 an hour. And it's, you know, but as I said, you know, it's building a social movement, and it's getting people to debate. And that when we pass it, the employing class will go berserk, of course. And that's a good thing, because we need the debate, because people have bought into this nonsense that, you know, you've got to compete with your shareholder of what they're allowed to think, pay. And, of course, you don't have the economic power to actually compete. And so you're going to – so workers just agree.
Well, and, like I said, comes back to the real fallacy of the market, per se. One of the things I was quite interested about – That's a quite an in-depth and amusing discussion for another day, I guess. One of the things that's quite interesting about is I've seen the good old-fashioned left-right argument, $15 minimum wage, inflation, rah-de-rah-de-rah. But what I found interesting was some of the left discussion around this. And what a post was put up on Bryce's blog, liberation.typepad.com, by a guy named John Moore, and he put up a couple of criticisms and a couple of things saying, think this is good, think this is bad, here are some ideas. One of the things he says is that many wages are failing to keep up with inflation, hence someone earning $15 an hour back in 2000 might not be earning $15 an hour in 2009, and any future minimum wage increases will not necessarily affect them at all. He also says that the current campaign for a living wage does not seem to advocate industrial action to win higher wages, but follows the General Council of Trade Unions line of using non-militant tactics to pressure the government. How does that fit in with there? Where does Unite see itself within that critique?
Well, you know, and I always try and be polite about keyboard sort of revolutionaries. I really, but it's just kind of, well, so, you know, I mean, it's like, it's not what people say, it's what they do, you know, and you've got to, yes, I'm sure I could, look, I could come up with a perfect plan too and have all the theoretical sort of arguments. I don't want to be disrespectful, but it's like, it doesn't mean anything, you know? It's like, you know, it's about, when you're close to workers, they're dealing with bread and butter issues, right? Unless you connect with that, you know, you do nothing, you know? And the proof is in your numbers, you know? All talk's cheap, but in the end, it's about, will people be mobilized to do things? Of course, that $15 is not the answer. Of course, it's not. You know, but anyone who knows their revolutionary history and writings know that the leaders of successful ones have always said, "You must first start where workers are at." You got it. You know, and so the theoretical discourse is important. You know, because you've got to have that intellectual thing. But I kind of, you know, I have to look for solutions, and I have to look at how we mobilise. We've got to get the debate going. I think that's part of the debate. But, you know, when you go down and it's disconnected from kind of, you know, the activism on the ground, it kind of doesn't mean a great deal, you know. And so, yes, fine, you know, and I'm busy, you know. And so, I haven't read John's stuff, but I've heard the similar arguments. But you see, it's like saying, well, we need a general strike now, you know, we need to mobilize in the streets and thousands, say, yeah, okay, well, you know, I go on every demo in Auckland, I do, and I know how many, I know everyone on that first name base sort of basis, you know. The left activism is isolated. I think it's ghettoised. I think it's removed from the working class, and I think you have to engage with working class people and with the youth. And you know, we won the defeat of youth wages by actually winning it with McDonald's and the other sites, you know, and fast foods, by industrial action. We won it community by getting kids who we paid for the buses to come down and hold demos in town in Auckland here, with about 1,500 at one and 1,000 at another on May Day. You know, they went on school strikes with the radical youth, and then we lobbied politically and got the Māori Party over. We got the Green Party, was always very supportive, and most of the Labour Party, and New Zealand First in the end. So we got it then electorally. So that's what we do. And of course, it's not one thing. It needs to be a whole number of things. So You know, and I know John, and you know, and I have respect for him, but you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's what you do.
I guess from there, I
don't need to be told how to fuck eggs, sort of, really.
I guess from there is that there's, I guess the CTU method over the last sort of while of partnership, of consultation, of having petitions and stuff, and there's a petition out there for a right to work or something like that that's sitting out outside the radio station at the moment. How do you see the Unite's petition, which on the surface seems to be a similar form to the tried and failed practices of the past? How do you see that differentiating?
No, that's very fair. And that's a very good question. Of course, it's not, you know, you could say it's not a petition. Yes, it is a petition, but it's building a social movement where workers going out on the worksite with their clipboards and talking about, and then weigh our claims in our collective agreements, and it's about saying we've got to introduce it. What we're also, which is unique about this, which is the first one I've ever seen anyway, is we've also got everyone's potential for everyone's email and their details to go on. And half of the people who are putting their names and signing the referendum are putting their details down and are linking into an email. And so we are able to communicate through the next year or 2 years this campaign goes on with people who support sort of raising sort of workers' wages. And that's going to be, I think, have great influence in the future, because it's about 1,000 people getting active, but then they're going to say, well, this in itself is not enough. And I think we will get the referenda, of course. I mean, who wouldn't support it? Well, I mean, ruling class won't, but I mean, most of us will.
They're a minority
for a reason.
But
then it's actually sort of building the, yes, and it's going to build an activism, but in a network to do other things as well. And so, you know, we're a trade union or a community union, we're not an organisation which is just doing the referenda. It's all connected. And the proof for me is every site we go on that people get excited by and that people want to then talk about other issues. So it's actually the first thing you talk about, issues they want to talk about, which is about money. And then once you are engaged in the issues which are important to them, then you can talk about the other issues, and people, they step up for that as well.
Oh, true. I guess just before we go, something I've noticed over the last little while, in the last couple of months, is that I've seen, especially with this recession, is that what you're seeing huge amounts of new unemployed and people who aren't used to being unemployed, so a whole new group of people who aren't used to this process, who aren't used to this experience. Lane Walker Rudkin was an interesting one with that. But there's been criticism from a number of your organisers, I think, Omar Hami, Jared Phillips, and I just see John Minto on the Stuff website, about the tactics and the strategies and the responses,
yeah,
particularly of the NDU, which you guys have quite a close relationship with. How do you see that quite public sort of political engagement fitting in within Unite, but also within the wider union movement?
Well, yes. Well, I read Omar and some of his sponsors. I mean, all of us can be critical of each other, and I always come from the thing is, yes, well, there's a lot of things Unite drops the ball on too, so I'm not one to point the finger about anything. That the NDU is a good union and it tries and does a good job. You know, it's not a soft and a partnership union which doesn't try. And I think that the criticism of that issue, you know, is two sides. But the thing is, what you've got to build is a culture of the left, is that people have got to be free to be able to say what they like and what they want to contribute. And I think it's a constructive, you know, there's a bit of backs up in the end of you about it, you know, saying, well, you know, I mean, we're in a fight and we're trying to do our best, and, you know, we don't need to be sort of, you know, white-entered by our mates. But I think it's important to have that discourse. You know, I get pretty with John's analysis of our campaign, but at the same time, you see, you've got to say, well, the left will never be a healthy left if people aren't free to say what they think. And so, whilst, you know, that sometimes we don't like the criticism, I think it's like, if it's constructive, or that the people who are saying it are out there on the blocks as well, then I think, you know, it should be encouraged. And So, you know, I think it's trying to get a confident and a healthy left instead of a defensive one.
Oh, sweet. Well, cheers for that, Matt. Would I just get a plug for our show that we can add into it? Would you be able to say that you listen to the Joel Cosgrove Variety Hour?
Sorry, what's it called?
The Joel Cosgrove Variety Hour.
Yep. It's Matt McCartan. I listen to the Joel Cosgrove Variety Hour, even if it is in Wellington.
Oh, sure. Thanks for that, Matt.
Do you want me to say it again?
Yeah, why not?
Joel, because I stuff it then. This is Matt McCartan, and I will always listen to the Joel Cosgrove Variety Hour.
As long
it's the
as
best little
that
show
name.
In Wellington. How's that?
Cheers. We'll keep the top, but before I interrupt on you. Cheers for that, Matt. Enjoy the rest of your day.
I will. Okay, brother. Cheers. Bye-bye.
That was Matt McCartan, General Secretary of the National Secretary of the Unite Union. Enjoy the rest of the hour. There is 5 minutes left, unless this clock is actually wrong, which I believe it might be, which is possibly why the next DJ is floating around outside. Enjoy.